We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. I'm Giselle Atterbury, guest host for this focus program concerning the Farnsworth House, designed in 1951 by Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. With me today by telephone is the executive director of the Farnsworth House, Whitney French. Good morning, Whitney.
Good morning, Giselle.
Nice to chat with you, and I guess I should let listeners know right away that I'm a docent at the Farnsworth House, and I consider Whitney a friend, and so this will be quite chatty, I guess. For those of you wanting to phone, the numbers for the show are 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. You may also join the discussion by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Again, that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Whitney, it must be a beautiful day up in Plano right now. What I'd like you to do is more or less set the stage. Let's say you're leaving the visitor center just outside of Plano. It's a wonderful rural retreat, and you're walking along about a quarter mile of the Fox River, and the Farnsworth House comes into view. What do you see?
Well, it's nice that it emerges in the way that it does. The property itself is quite delightfully landscaped with approximately 1,500 specimen trees throughout the 62 acres of property we have. And so as you emerge across a small bridge with the river to your left and the formal Farnsworth House property to your ahead of you, the house itself, there are a few trees that shadow it. So you emerge upon it, and it comes out of the woods, and it is truly breathtaking. It is a beautiful, elevated, simple, clean-lined steel and glass box that's reflecting in this perfect, in these perfect glass walls, all of the beautiful nature that surrounds it. And of course, on a day like today, the sun is shining and the grass is still green and the leaves are just beginning to turn color, and so it's really a stunning visual assault.
It really, really, truly is amazing. And as amazing as the house is, the story behind the house, its inception, maintaining it, there's plenty of drama there as well. Maybe we should just get started with who was Ludwig Mies van der Rohe by the time that he met the client for this house, Edith Farnsworth? What was his importance?
Well, Mies van der Rohe had begun to gain fame in Germany, was the director of the Bauhaus School of Architecture before coming to Illinois and being invited by what was then the Armour Institute and now is the Illinois Institute of Technology to become its director of architecture. This was in the late 30s, and Mies was anxious to escape the war and toyed with the idea of taking this position and eventually did. He was the director of the School of Architecture. He was responsible for the construction and design and planning of its campus, which is a beautiful display of modern architecture, well-respected and regarded to this day. And had begun a private practice when the client, Dr. Farnsworth, approached him with, from what I would determine most architects would agree, is the ideal project. You have an architect whose practice is primarily in these large-scale commercial and educational institutional buildings and galleries and skyscrapers and apartments and office complexes and you know, the beautiful Crown Hall. His practice had not been focused on residential, though he had a few European residential projects under his belt at this time. And so the client approached him because she had a stated desire to advance the art of modern architecture and to contribute to its evolution in some way. That, in and of itself, is very attractive to an architect, and I always imagine me thinking, well, certainly the client isn't capable of designing a great piece of work, and so, therefore, he concludes there must be freedom of design in this project. then you have the added benefit of getting out of the rural environment in which he'd been constructing these lovely minimal steel and glass pieces of architecture, and into this very beautiful rural oasis where, first, there's much less code requirement, so that you have some freedom of design and less constriction of the code requirement issues. You also have a client who has enough wealth to pay you for a rather exorbitantly priced home. This house was built for $74,000 in an era when the average American home was about $5,000 or $6,000. And it was a weekend retreat. So all the necessity and programmatic requirements of full-time residential structures could be somewhat ignored. You have just a highly evolved cabin, and that is a really attractive enticement for the architect. And so I think that they struck up a great relationship, and the design in 1945 was the result of several meetings between them on the property, and then a little bit of a leeway between that design and the construction in 1951, in which they could tweak the design. The construction actually began in 49, and I think that they had spent a lot of time together and really gotten down to a nearly perfect dwelling.
It's a quintessence of elegance when you move to it, up to it, close, and in it. It's just every step of the way an absolute elegance. You brought about a few moments ago the experience of seeing it for the first time. And as a tour guide, I mean, there are people who practically break into tears or do, in effect, break into tears. It's so elegant. And, you know, it's just wonderful to think that we, again, had this very enlightened patron who wanted to advance architecture. And lucky her, she was able to achieve that. And she did enjoy the house for more than 20 years. But there were troubles in paradise. Would you like to describe what happened between Ludwig Mies van der Rohe and Edith Farnsworth?
Certainly, to the best that we know, trying to forego what is, you know, that which is more gossip than anything else, I theorize and can, from between the correspondence between the two, I think that there's pretty decent proof that if you engage in the type of person that Dr. Farnsworth was, this is, you know, in the early 30s, she acquired her medical license. She was a nephrologist by trade, a specialist of the kidney. She spoke five languages. She was a concert-level violinist and, in fact, had toyed with the idea of going into the playing of violin as a profession as opposed to medicine. Rumor has it she was nominated for a Nobel Prize for her participation in the development of a component of steroids. And she was a published poet. And in that era, I think it was a challenge for a female with all of those intelligent attributes to find an equal to share that with. And I think that she and Mies, based on the correspondence they had between them, often debated philosophy and different perspectives on government and art and architecture. And I think that for her to find someone to engage with was an incredibly attractive and an inspirational thing. And she also has this man who's becoming famous around the world designing her weekend retreat and allowing her to participate, or so she thought, in that process. But as things evolved and the construction began and the cost began to rise, and she at one point began to recognize that she had much less control than she had originally been led to believe, and she was not having influence, that he was more allowing her to believe that she was having influence on the house. And so she tried to enact a few changes to the house, and there were a few personal battles, and suddenly she began to complain. She complained to one of her patients, who happened to be a lawyer, near the end of the project, when she'd received a bill for materials of $4,500. And the lawyer said, "Let me assist you. I mean, here is this doctor saving his life, and he wanted to offer some help." And so he wrote a letter to Mies van der Rohe stating that they would make an offer, a settlement of $1,500 on the $4,500 request. And this offended Mies. And so his office, which was undergoing an evaluation by a business manager Philip Johnson had sent his way, decided to tack on before that point, what had been decided would not be charged Dr. Farnsworth, $10,000 in architectural fees. And they served her a new bill for $10,000 or $14,500 under the guise of a lawsuit. She countersued. A great debate ensued that lasted for several years and was highly publicized. She slandered him in the press and accused him of all sorts of things. But at the end of the court case, Meese did emerge victorious. He was found in favor in all 23 counts of the complaint. But he did not end up recovering fully his fees and unfortunately spent an incredible amount of money in legal fees to defend himself.
And sadly, according to accounts I've heard, never saw the house finished. He was there as it was in progress, but never saw this gem himself firsthand completed. That's a very sad thing.
It truly is. And he was made the offer by his grandson when Dr. Farnsworth, after losing her second lawsuit that resulted in 2 acres of the property being consumed by eminent domain for the construction of a bridge, which is very disruptive to the site. Dirk Lohan actually offered the site, Dirk Lohan being Meese Vandrell's grandson, actually offered the site to his grandfather and said, perhaps you would like to buy the Farnsworth house and spend some quiet time in your later years. He was about 86 at the time. And he refused. He wanted nothing to do with it. And would not come out here. Now, at this point, it's 20 years into the life of the house, and it has gained incredible fame. In fact, Dr. Farnsworth complained constantly that she couldn't keep the prying eyes of the architects and the architectural paparazzi from her yard. And though the house is set on an incredibly private lot, it is all glass. And so when someone decides to trespass, it is quite an intrusion to your feeling of security and privacy. And the reason, quite honestly, it's open for tours now is because the house is studied in every architectural program in the world. And the curious architects, being a traveling set and a very tactile profession, they understand the value of physically being in the site versus trying to understand it from photographs and drawings. And so they flock here in great numbers.
Yes, they certainly do. It's not at all unusual to give a tour to people from points throughout the world. In fact, most often when I give a tour, I find that someone has come from abroad to see the house. There's just such curiosity about it, such excitement about it, and for good reason. And I think maybe our listeners who have seen the house in photographs need to really understand that the experience of it firsthand is it's majestic. It soars beyond the photographs. Now, we have this very contentious relationship between Edith Farnsworth and Ludwig Meese van der Rohe, and yet she stays in the house. And she tries to adjust, and she moves in some of her own furniture, of course, and personal belongings, and puts up with heat and cold, rising waters from the very nearby Fox River, insects. Franz Schulz wrote a really wonderful biography of Ludwig Meese van der Rohe. He describes the house as more nearly a temple than a dwelling. And she had problems living in it on a regular basis. I don't think she ever lived in it for extended periods of time. You would know that. But, I mean, a couple weeks or so, a week, it would certainly pose problems.
I think there are some challenges. And, you know, it is a confluence of the school of the Bauhaus. The theories in the Bauhaus, which was the school of architecture that Meese and Gropius and others were involved in Germany, was really this idealism that the spaces in which we created for people to live could alter the way they behaved. And that if someone requested the ability to, you know, I want a place in which I can meditatively relax. You know, I think a key understanding in Dr. Farnsworth was that her professional life at this stage, she was desperately researching ways to resolve and solve and cure diseases of the kidney in children. And she failed more often than not. And so as a profession, she was watching children die. What a terrible, stressful choice. And so this lends new insight into this building and its intent. And Meese truly believed and carried forth this idea of the Bauhaus that by creating a specific space you can alter human behavior.
Well, it's it's very noble thought.
Created it flexibly enough so that next evolutions of human behavior would be able to adapt. The house has an incredibly timeless quality.
Exactly. And as you were saying, too, what a confluence, because Mies comes out of the chaos of World War I, beginnings of World War II, the horrible Nazi takeover, Dr. Farnsworth, that incredible stress. And here is a structure that through its reductivist, minimalist vocabulary is almost like a centering of the soul or a centering of the inner being. And I think one of the delights of the house is just to walk in and be quiet for a bit and let it wash over you. And it is extraordinary and possibly unique. I don't know. I don't know of anything else quite like it. And again, going so far beyond photography. Now, the next owner of the home, Edith Farnsworth, decides she's very upset with the building of the bridge, which, again, when you visit the site, you'll hear the traffic from the bridge. And when the leaves are less full, you're certainly going to see traffic. And we have Lord Peter Palumbo coming into the equation. Would you like to talk about that a bit, please?
Certainly. Lord Palumbo, we pay homage to on all of our tours. The site, as we recognize it now, shows some of his influence. For the first time since its construction, Lord Palumbo honored Moore the intent of Mies van der Rohe, furnishing it with Mies's, a collection of Mies's furniture, and really celebrating the landscape and the style of the architecture. Lord Palumbo, a British citizen, was a collector of modern architecture. He still owns a Frank Lloyd Wright house in Pennsylvania called Kentucknob, which he's also has open for tours.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time owned Maison Jules, which is a Corbusier in Paris. So he had been fond of the Farnsworth house since he was a child. He had seen pictures of it and fancied it greatly. And when he had inquired of Mies's office whether it might be possible for Mies to design a vacation home for him in Europe. Mies at this point was advanced in age. It came to his attention that the Farnsworth house was for sale, and so he immediately set out to purchase it. He was, for the 30 years that he owned this house, an incredible steward, a man of great wealth who was capable of the maintenance requirements of the house, and who invested a great deal in enhancing the property for his enjoyment as a vacation retreat a couple of weeks every year. He celebrated the architecture, but he also was a grand collector of art. He is still, I say was here in the property, he is still alive and in fact is currently the chairman of the Pritzker Prize Committee, which is respected as the greatest architectural prize you can receive. And so it's a man of this caliber who once owned this house and respectfully maintained it, resurrected it from the 1996 devastating flood in which the water rose 25 feet from its normal height and made its way into the house at a height of over 5 feet above the floor level, which hovers 6 feet off the ground. So he engaged in a $500,000 restoration at that point just to maintain the house and restore it to its glory after the damage from the water.
Well, let's come back to the matter of flooding in a few more moments, but let's get back to the house. Even in the 1950s, as it was finished, as you said, extremely popular. People knew about it even before construction started in earnest because of a model that went on display at the Museum of Modern Art. There was lots of talk, lots of chatter. The house is built. Edith Farnsworth and Mies van der Rohe have this parting of the ways, for lack of better words. And the house really comes under some heavy criticism. It's concocted essentially as a communist plot. Can I have you speak a little bit further to that?
Certainly. I think at this juncture, at that early stage, There were a couple of things that came together to give Mies this terrible slandered reputation in the press. The first being that indeed he had built a model of the house. He had sent it to the Museum of Modern Art at the request of its architectural curator, one Mr. Philip Johnson, who was at the time also being accused and, in fact, flaunted some communist theories. And this was, near to the McCarthy era.
Sure.
This was, you know, an era where all of this was being discussed. This was, of course, a German architect. And now he's engaged in the activity of providing a house in which the owner is discouraged from owning very many possessions. So certainly that would be a communist theory. Well, a young woman by the name of Elizabeth Gordon, who was the editor of Better Homes and Gardens magazine, wrote a scathing article after interviewing Dr. Farnsworth that alluded to exactly that fact and, in fact, called Mies van Dro directly out on the carpet and accused this of being some communist plot where this poor defenseless female was being forced into this glass cage against her will by this communist architect. And this is really a lot of the reason that Mies just wanted over with the court case. He had no desire to, nor to fight the slanderous reputation he was gaining in the press, and he had no way to stop it. You know, those gossip wheels, once they start turning, are pretty hard to evade. And so, I think that was a great deal of the cause for the settlement in the lawsuit.
And then, of course, Mies was, totally vindicated when he received the Medal of Freedom from Lyndon Johnson. And certainly by the 1960s, he was just widely regarded as a hero of modern architecture. It's, I suppose, into the 60s where we really begin to see the mass imitation of Mies's architecture, perhaps more often than not in a very favorable imitation, but nonetheless very widely imitated. Now, let's come back to Lord Palumbo. He's enjoyed the house. There has been a tremendous flood. He restores the house, and then he decides it's time to let it go.
And he had a series of problems plaguing him. The man leads an incredibly complex life, an issue that results, I'm sure, from such great wealth as he has. And things, including his health and some personal family issues and some monetary issues, began to get the best of him. And he decided it was time to part with the property and all of its improvements, which include a boathouse, a pool, tennis court, sauna, and the 33 sculpture that he had on the property. And so after an unsuccessful attempt at private sale, which alerted the preservationists, because you never know what's going to happen to a home if it's given into the hands of someone who's not a responsible steward of the relevance and historical value of this house, he made unsuccessful attempts at the private sale, made a then unsuccessful attempt at a sale to the state of Illinois, and with a change of governors, the deal that was in the works and was being negotiated fell through, and I think out of frustration, he decided to put the house up for auction. The auction held on December 12th of 2003 through the Sotheby's Auction House in New York auctioned the house as a piece of fine art. It was not an architectural auction, but an art auction. And this raised the awareness of the preservationists. There is a group still involved with the house we refer to as the Friends of the Farnsworth House. They are philanthropists, architectural and arts fans in Chicago primarily, who see this as a mighty work of art and an incredible asset to Illinois. And they sprung into action and got the National Trust for Historic Preservation and the Landmark Preservation Council of Illinois involved in the process, and in a very, very short time frame of just under 6 weeks, those three organizations managed to do what I deemed at the time was the impossible, and they raised the necessary funds to secure the house and become the winning bidders at an incredibly dramatic auction on that day. The final price tag hovers just under $7.5 million, and we are incredibly grateful to that fundraising effort that secured it so that it could remain open to the public and available for tours, which occur here, as you know, Giselle, on a daily basis, Tuesdays through Sundays from April through November, and never a day goes by that we don't welcome visitors.
Exactly. For those of you just tuning in, this is Focus 580, and I am speaking with Whitney French, Executive Director of the Farnsworth House. And yes, Whitney, you mentioned that the house is open to the public. I suppose the best way for people to find out about taking a tour is simply to go to the website for the house. And
right.
Though you can drop in for a tour, it's probably always, always best to make an appointment ahead of time.
And there are several days that we are completely booked and have the regrettable task of having to turn away people who travel incredible distances to come see the house, and it's always a heartbreaker for us. But the website, which is www.farnsworthhouse.org, shows our full tour calendar. The 2011 calendar will also have the advantage of some wonderful things. We're adding some additional exhibits next year. We hope to have lights in the house, similar to the ones that Lord Palumbo once furnished the house with, so we can do some night tours and some really unique things. So there are going to be some great opportunities to engage in some special events. And like you had recognized earlier, Giselle, that opportunity to really just absorb the house at a slower pace. One of the difficulties we have in the tour program here is that our guides are all incredibly passionate. And the challenge we put before them to try to limit their information to just, 60 minutes creates an environment where a truly engaged group of visitors and a truly engaged docent can make it difficult to really sit back and enjoy and relax a property. And so we try to allow a little free time at the end so that people can sit about the place on the decks and in the yard and just kind of really absorb the environment and the intent of this beautiful, pristine little temple.
Exactly. And I think we both probably can't stress enough what a nice retreat into the countryside a visit to the Farnsworth House is today. When you take the little walk along the river, you have the opportunity to chat with others who are making the visit. We do allow plenty of time for people to take exterior photographs. The sighting for the house is just lovely. Then there's the walk back, and there's always time for question and dialogue in that little bit of a walk. And again, just a wonderful excursion into the countryside to see the Farnsworth House. It's very easy to make an afternoon of it. Now,
next year we will have the addition, just to mention on that walk, also the addition to kind of stroll through the property a bit. We are working with Mises University, the Illinois Institute of Technology, and for the foreseeable future, their first year architectural student projects, which are always interesting constructions, are being hosted here on the site at the close of the school year. So from early May through the early fall, we have sculpture created by students that can be enjoyed and contemplated, and we begin to see the emerging of the next great era of architecture.
Yes, exactly. That's what it's all about, the inspiration that a home like this provides. Now, let's get back to the matter of flooding. There is the constant threat today of the Fox River, and it's so unpredictable because, one would typically think of flooding in the spring, but we've had that horrible September flood as part of the house's history. I'll let you address that matter.
Necessarily hold any architect on a platform as though they're some kind of god, but I will defend Mies for the occasional hit he takes from people who think that he was unwise in the location for building the house. It is now in the state of Illinois illegal to build in the floodplain, but at the time, Mies elevated the house to what they believe, based on the best research they could do at the time, was a foot above the 100-year floodplain. And then he constructed the house of materials, steel, glass, and stone, that could withstand the occasional drenching. And so the house is designed so that even though it sits in a floodplain, the floodplain can still act in the way the floodplain is designed and hold water that overflows from the river. In Mises' defense, in 2006, the Army Corps of Engineers reassessed the Kendall County area, the county in which the house exists, for the floodplain levels, and indeed confirm that he is a foot above the 100-year floodplain. the unfortunate mathematical reality and the ever-pressing effect of development in this, which was for the long, for 7 years, the fastest-growing county in Illinois, is that those effects can alter rather quickly. But it does sit above the floodplain. Reality is it floods about once every 10 years on the interior or a foot above the 100-year floodplain. The first in 1954, we believe, when Dr. Farnsworth was victimized by, we think, perhaps 2 feet of water. She lost her investment in silk shintong drapery and spent the next 16 years with bamboo roller shades, which I think was part of the privacy issue she experienced. Quite honestly. And then we had the disastrous flood of 96, 5 feet of water above the first floor. We were victimized again in August of 08, 13 inches of water. We are in the process of enacting the restoration from that, but also engaged in the process of mitigation and how can we prevent the floods. Very sensitive to the need to protect the architectural intent and our preservation mantra, which is, really, it's a house that absorbs the landscape so significantly that you can't make alterations to the landscape without affecting the architecture. And so we can't dike or dam or damage the view of the river that we have. We don't want to divert the river or do anything to modify that beautiful view out that of that horizontal element out this long expanse of glass. And some have suggested that perhaps we install hydraulic jacks under the house and have it lifted. I personally fear that the house's tolerances are so exact and so extreme that any jostling or removal of the house from its site puts it at risk. I have had the great luxury of working with a bunch of the fans of the house, the University of Delft and the University of Rotterdam in the Netherlands, our very good friends who know a lot about flood control. And we're working on some projects that might devise a solution that would be less detrimental to those two areas, both the view or the protection of the physical architecture and the view from the house. And we've come up with some ingenious ideas, engineering marvels that we are putting before the powers that be for their contemplation and some engineering reviews now that hopefully in the future will protect the house. I've been the director here and on site for 4 years, and I've had occasion to boat to the house on 9 separate events. 4 of those, by the way, being in the winter. So even in the winter, we can experience some extreme flooding.
Yes, and kudos for you becoming an ice watcher, because, again, part of the problem is when the ice jams break, it's almost unpredictable, and then the water comes gushing forward.
That's
correct. So that's a big problem. But this came up yesterday in discussing Frank Lloyd Wright. The house is, I think, in the minds of every one of us who offer tours there, absolutely and thoroughly site-specific. And Mies only designed 3 homes that were actually built here in the United States. The other 2 have been altered. This one is as much as possible as it was built, and no one likes the idea of cutting it down and moving it 50 feet up the hill. It just that doesn't work. I could hardly speak it. It was such a bad idea. But, that's a really hard thing sometimes for our visitors, but I think it was designed to be interactive with nature, and nature's the primary force, so we've got to figure it out. That's all there is to it. It's just a matter of money in the long run, I guess, but it is encouraging that there are ideas coming out of the Netherlands that potentially could be quite helpful. Now, again, preserving the house in these economic times is a bit of a challenge. Again, there are a regular stream of visitors, but you are engaged in some new activities that should benefit the house as well. How about a few words on Modern Views?
What a delightful project and what an enlightening experience it's been for us. We have the good fortune, both Philip Johnson's glass house, and that, by the way, is a house in New Canaan, Connecticut. When Philip Johnson was curator of MoMA and saw the model of Farnsworth, he became incredibly curious about the concept and built the glass house in New Canaan, Connecticut. as an experiment in 1949. Both the Philip Johnson Glass House and the Farnsworth House are now the property of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which is a private not-for-profit organization who has a nationwide and now becoming internationally wide influence on advocacy and preservation issues, and owns or is involved in 29 historic sites. So the two sites partnered together, myself and the director at the Glass House, a woman by the name of Christy McClear, when we saw an idea in Italy where artwork was donated and auctioned off to raise money for the restoration of a church. And here it became, because our audience is so much from the arts and design and architecture environment, it became a natural outpouring. And because, as you had stated earlier, this house is cited continuously, as is the Glass House in New Canaan and Philip Johnson's work in the arts, they are influences to the modern and new and continuing evolution of art in America and abroad. And so we decided to ask famous artists, architects, and designers, and landscape architects, if they could put into some physical sense a drawing or a model or some piece of work that they would be willing to contribute to us that is inspired by the ideas of Glass House and Farnsworth. And we got an overwhelming response from that community, incredibly generous donations. Every piece of work of the 100 that we received, the 100 that we received, came with a 100-word essay. And all of that work was photographed and the essays published in a book that's just come out called Modern Views, which we're carrying now at the gift shop, that is a beautiful expression of how these two beautiful pieces of architecture can continue to influence this environment. Those pieces of art are a portion of them were auctioned successfully, I might add, at an event held here in Chicago on the 16th, and our second event will be October 6th in New York City. Tickets still available for anyone who might find themselves in the area on that day. We'll be hosting another live and silent auction event, and the premiere of a new film called that asks the question, a documentary that asks the question, "Where would you rather live?" of a bunch of noted artists and architects, and it's quite wonderful. And another film that was developed as a part of this project by Sarah Morris, which is it's entitled Points on a Line, and displays not only incredible high-definition photography of Glass House, but also the Seagram's Building in New York that was a co-project of Philip Johnson and Mies van der Rohe, and then 86880 Lakeshore Drive here in Chicago, one of Mies's apartment complexes, and then out to the Farnsworth House. So it's a really lovely piece of art that Sarah Morris developed. And that is all part of this event, both on the past on the 16th of September and the one coming up on October. And the goal is to raise $1 million for restoration projects at the two sites, always ongoing restoration, both of them at about 60 years of age right now, just require another round of maintenance, which, as everyone's aware that owns a home, can be a little costly, and especially in buildings of this nature.
Since you were mentioning that the book is now available at the Visitor Center or gift shop, it's a rather minor point, but it is one of the best bookshops for publications on modern architecture that I think I've ever encountered. It's just one of the pleasures of visiting the Farnsworth House is the array of new publications, of course, focused on Mies, but going well beyond Mies as well. So if you need yet another reason to come out and visit, there it is. It's just a wonderful source of information. Now, you have a very close relationship with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and the Farnsworth House is one of, more than a couple dozen homes that they help to administrate, correct?
That is correct. And they range. Not all of them are modern. I think we're really citing three or four buildings in the modern perspective. We have Philip Johnson's Mies's, and then also two Frank Lloyd Wright properties, three altogether, because you've got the Holman Studio in Oak Park, Robey House on the south side of Chicago, and as well Pope Leahy, which is a Frank Lloyd Wright house, I believe in Virginia. And all of those sites together constitute kind of this modern, you know, this evolving. The National Trust also has an initiative called Modernism in the Recent Past, which is hosted out of our Western Region office in California, because it's become quite highly recognized that these properties, because they're not the antiquities of, you know, 100 years ago, but they're still a great relevance to this turn and this alteration for which Mies was so influential, this capturing of this mid-century modern spirit. And it speaks so much of the culture of our country, what was going on in this era, and what these architects were contributing. And these projects, so much of this architecture is currently at risk, and the recognition that it needs to be preserved is just becoming an awareness of the preservation community. And so there's a lot of work to do, a lot of advocacy, and a lot of policy alterations that really protect, you know, the Route 66 and the neon signs and this whole era of human history that speaks so much to the American psyche of the mid-century.
Precisely, and it's just an amazing thing how a house can offer such an opportunity for these ideas to merge. It's wonderful to have visitors who have a strong technical background, and they just become almost poetic over Mies's use of steel. Steel is an exoskeleton for this structure. And it sounds cold and harsh, and steel might sound rather brutish and ponderous, but it becomes so elegant, so delicate, and almost ethereal in its presentation here. And it's just to lose this or to see it moved would be absolutely heartbreaking. And it's so encouraging to have people come and say, yeah, you know, I'm going to support this house. I've visited, and now I'm going to continue to support it one way or another. And visiting is a way of supporting the house, quite fortunately. To have the visitors there to pay the admittance fee and to talk further about it is a great deal of help. And again, many people like to come out at various times through the year. May is an excellent time to visit because of the plantings that Lord Palumbo helped to engineer. There's a burst of daffodils across the hills. And many of our city visitors just love to take in the scope of nature that surrounds the house. It is a bit different today. It's mowed rather than a true meadow. But it's, I think, so advantageous now to have the walk to the house, because you do begin to quiet down from the ride or the visits that you've had, and just submerge yourself in nature, as Edith Farnsworth must have done leaving the city.
I can't agree more. You know, one of the issues we have, the challenges of the Farnsworth house, is a reflection of the absolute intent of the original client, and that it is not easy to get to. It can be a challenge, which is testament to the visitors that come here, that they make the journey. It's not impossible. It's a little over an hour from the city of Chicago, but we don't have the advantage of easy to use mass transit. It is a quiet, nestled little place in the country. And though that can affect a little bit the revenue that we generate to support the house, because the number of visitors is much lower, we've had great discussions, particularly this year. The Farnsworth House is considered probably second only in the country in its impact on modern architecture to Falling Water, Frank Lloyd Wright's beautiful execution in Pennsylvania, where they welcome an enormous number of guests every year, and I always contemplate how devastating that must be to the architecture to have that many people. And I speak to people quite often that have just finished touring there, and they're on a little modern architecture tour of the U.S., and they then come out to the Farnsworth House and enjoy the experience so much more here, because, as you know, it's just really peaceful and really relaxing, and our group visits are small, and you get quiet time, and you're not followed, and you're not herded, you're not followed by another group right on your tail, and you're really allowed some freedom to breathe in the site and to experience, to allow it to affect you in a way that a standard house tour that you're, you know, really guided strictly through, it's so much different. And I look at that struggle to arrive here by vehicle that some people engage in. I look at that path as a way to erase, as you said, the stress of that traffic and the stress of the journey. And by the time you get to the house, you're in a much more peaceful and relaxed place.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. And I still look at the site, though, and I think, you know, it's not that extraordinary for Illinois. A slight sloping hill down to a stream. We see those everywhere, and yet the house does something to nature. It frames it. It makes you more conscious of the difference between the rationally designed block of glass and steel as opposed to the free flow of natural events. It's just an extraordinary thing, and we're still so fortunate indeed to have it. Talking about travel, if people would want to come visit the Farnsworth House, as we've mentioned earlier, the best way is to contact the website. Do you want to give the phone number again once again,
certainly.
Please?
The website is farnsworthhouse.org, and the phone number to reach us here is 630-552-0052. Also contact us by email, farnsworth@farnsworthhouse.org.
And again, with light traffic about an hour out of Chicago, my first tour group this year was from a University of Milan, and we finished up the tour at, late afternoon, and the professor looked over at me and said, "Great, in another hour we're going to be in our hotel in Chicago." And I said, maybe not so much. You do have to allow for traffic coming out of the city. But for those of us down in southern Illinois, a quick route up 47, turn at, your choice. There's a number of ways from Yorkville, and it would lead you out. And the last time I was out with my husband, he was delighted to find the park across the way. And if you packed a picnic lunch, really, you could easily make a day out of it. It's just a wonderful, wonderful location. And as you said, it is continuously inspirational. It is possible to make a visit both to Ludwig Mies van der Rohe's Illinois Institute of Technology campus and the Farnsworth House in a single day. That option's open, too, isn't it?
Certainly. And I think certainly if anyone is interested in making a bigger day out of it, they're welcome to call us, and we're happy to recommend. We've become well-versed in where you can go to pick apples. There's a winery nearby. There is a brand-new whitewater rafting kayak chute about to open nearby. So the realm of possibilities is enormous. There's paddle boats across the river. I would also add that for anyone making the journey, we are a participant in a delightful website called Visit Historic Illinois, and that website will allow you to choose your route and look at other historic homes, if that's your interest, that you might want to visit on the journey, so that you can plan to go to two or three different houses in a day. You just pick the route. If you're coming north on Route 47, it will tell you how many houses are accessible from that route. So it's a delightful resource.
Thank you. I didn't even know about that, so I'll keep that in mind. One of the things I wanted to point out about the house is the furnishings inside. We have furnishings of Ludwig Mies van der Rohe's design, and also those by his grandson, Dirk Lohan, who has been, of course, tremendous help in interpreting the house and preserving the house. Would you want to comment on the furnishings, perhaps, that Dirk Lohan designed for the house?
Certainly. There are actually three pieces of furniture, and it is my understanding we had Dirk out about a month ago, that he, by popular demand of the beautiful design of these pieces, is likely to put them into some kind of production. They are a desk with winged bookshelves, a boot box, which I had always termed as a foot locker, but no, indeed, it is a boot box designed for holding wellies and the like. And a lovely floating platform bed that Dirk designed with recessed nightstands and drawers that contain that are designed to hold the pillows from the bed for storage during the day. All three of those pieces of furniture are designed to complement both the table that is of Mises' design but was rebuilt by Dirk, and the wardrobe that is one of those controversial items but is an original component of the architecture. And I am quite certain by the evidence I've seen a design of Mies van der Rohe's.
Right. The house does attract people who are pretty strictly furniture aficionados, not just interested in the architecture itself. Well, I want to thank you, Whitney, for being with me today, and I look forward to being to the Farnsworth House again very, very soon. This is almost an ideal time of year to see it, to see the trees starting to change, and again, to just kind of soak up the quiet and the proportions of the house. It's a great experience. Thank you very much for being with me today.
My pleasure.